At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Words matter, people. Words matter, especially when they are big, scary, economic words. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 23rd day of August. It is good, as always, to have you along, everybody. A bunch of words as we get going here to set up the word. Word came from the Census Bureau this morning of some not great housing data. Not great, that is, if you're a home builder or a real estate agent. New home sales, so not existing, or you might say, as I sometimes do, used homes, but homes with that freshly constructed new home smell, I suppose. Anyway, new home sales were down nearly 30% last month from a year ago. The National Association of Home Builders and the National Association of Realtors have both said we are in a, quote, housing recession. Spoiler alert, that's the big scary economic word, recession. But we are still seeing home prices and rents at or near all-time highs. So what housing recession are they talking about? Marketplace's Matt Levin starts us off.
Back in my day, a housing recession meant foreclosures and underwater mortgages and Ben Bernanke looking like he hadn't slept in 6 months. Sabrina Brown, a real estate agent in Fresno, California, has a similar definition.
You know, I started in 2006, and that was a recession. This right now is just, we are in a reality check.
Brown says rising mortgage rates have slowed demand. She no longer gets 10 bids within 24 hours of listing a home. And shockingly, buyers actually want to see a house before they buy it.
The home seller, they might say we're in a recession because they know their neighbor sold 6 months ago and got $50,000 over. And now when they put their house on the market, they're getting appraised value.
While prices are still high, nationally, the number of homes sold has declined for six straight months. And permits to build new single-family homes are down 6% year-to-date. Rob Dietz is an economist at the National Association of Home Builders.
When we refer to a housing recession, we're talking about the economic activity declining that's associated with the housing sector. That is primarily new home builds. Combined with home sales.
But remember, housing is more than just single-family homes. Apartment construction is actually up from last year, and rents are still climbing. Rob Warnock is with Apartment List.
So for landlords, I would not think that they're feeling much recession.
So what could send home and rent prices dropping faster? Well, a big recession in the overall economy. One big enough we all agree it's a recession. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
All right, another kind of building story now, but a tad more high-tech, to be clear. We all know we need more semiconductors, right? They are in everything, and chips are perhaps the symbol of the pandemic supply chain mishigas. The answer, obviously, is just to get chip makers to make more chips. But those factories, fabs, they're called, are still unbelievably expensive to build. There is, of course, the new CHIPS Act, $52-something billion in chip R&D and manufacturing. Also today, there is the OG chipmaker Intel saying it's going to partner with Brookfield Asset Management to invest $30 billion to expand Intel's facilities to build chips in Arizona. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looked into where all that private and public money might be taking us.
There's a thing that people who work in chip or semiconductor manufacturing like to say.
Semiconductors are now like the new natural resource.
Paula Pankow is an analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. She says people say that because so much can be built with semiconductors. And Pankow says with the new federal money, states are interested in attracting chip manufacturers.
I've had some states reach out to us, to me, wondering what they can do to draw business in to their state because they want it.
Pankow says there are certain things chip manufacturers need in a location. Lots of space, good sources of water and electricity, low risk of natural disasters, and ideally existing chip manufacturers, even if they're competitors. Because Nina Turner at IDC says,
they don't have to build and bring in new employees or new support companies.
Turner says each chip factory takes a minimum of $10 billion and 5 years to build. Companies aren't earning during construction. So along with public money and innovative financing models, companies need to be speedy. Willie Shi is a professor of management practice at Harvard.
When you go to Asia and look at them building one of these chip factories, you'll see them working on Christmas Day, pouring concrete, putting in structural steel and stuff like that.
She says once a company has taken the time and expense to build a plant, it's not likely to move anytime soon, which means the jobs should be there too. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little break from all the selling. I mean, there was still selling, just not as much as yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The inflation rate over in the UK, as I think we said when the Office of National Statistics over there published its latest figures, is 10.1%. That's the highest of all of the group of seven economies. Those are the world's biggest advanced democratic economies. Tens of thousands of workers over in Britain, train drivers to port workers to everything in between, have called strikes as their paychecks simply haven't been able to keep pace with that inflation. One big issue, and maybe the biggest for a lot of Brits, is the soaring cost of electricity and natural gas. More than 100,000 people are said to have joined a campaign of civil disobedience that could bring a mass refusal to pay household energy bills this fall and winter, when, of course, those bills could wind up being even higher. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
PhD student Hannah Absalom at her computer working on a thesis about poverty. And how's this for irony? She has herself now slipped into the same dire straits that are the subject of her dissertation.
I am in very financially squeezed circumstances. How do I feed myself affordably? How do I heat myself affordably?
Her modest salary as a university research assistant simply won't cover the doubling of her domestic heating and electricity bill that's expected this winter.
I find it bitterly laughable at how much they're suggesting people are going to have to find, including myself. I haven't got any more money left to give.
Due to the heavy reliance on natural gas for both domestic heating and for generating electricity, the average household energy bill in the UK has rocketed by over 200% over the past year. Another 80% plus hike is expected in October and a further 20% in January. Needless to say, many Brits are not happy.
I've had enough of energy companies raising prices whilst raking in billions.
This video launched a campaign led by labour unions demanding, among other things, a deep cut in energy bills with a familiar angry refrain.
Enough is enough.
Enough is enough.
It's time to channel anger into action.
Protest rallies are planned, but more ominous for the government and for the energy industry is an online civil disobedience campaign urging customers not to pay the gas and electricity bill. Louise Martindale, a private tutor, has joined that campaign against the energy price hikes.
I just thought, you know what, I am not going to sit back and just take this. I'm going to do something about it.
She's angry because her business has suffered in the cost of living crisis and she's struggling to pay for her daughter's urgently needed medical treatment and for her son's college tuition.
Then we're being told we've got to pay these huge increases as well, these energy increases, and we're finding ourselves now in this really impossible situation. So it's really bleak.
As a businesswoman, she says it goes against the grain to refuse to pay a bill, but she shrugs off the possible consequences.
You wouldn't be worried, though, that this might damage your credit rating?
No, I think credit rating becomes unimportant when you've got to decide between paying for your energy or caring for your children. And for a lot of people, that's the stage it's got to.
Although an extremely rare event, the energy companies can cut off power and gas supplies from non-paying households. But Tom Scott, a writer who also supports the Don't Pay campaign, doesn't believe it would come to that.
10,000 people not paying their bills is one thing, but a million people not paying is quite a different thing.
The Don't Pay campaigners say they'll only go ahead with the payment strike if a million people sign up for it. That, says Scott, will supply safety in numbers.
I think it's highly unlikely that if this movement does get off the ground, there will be any very severe action taken against people who take part in it.
The government has condemned the threatened payment strike, pointing out that it's already hit the energy companies with a $6 billion windfall profits tax, and that it's pumping around $44 billion into people's pockets to help defray household energy costs this winter. But that'll barely scratch the surface of the huge increases coming down the pike. Energy and the brewing rebellion will be the number one item on the agenda when the new Prime Minister takes office in the fall. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The social media hashtag of the week is Solidarity with Sana. Women around the world posting pictures and videos of themselves dancing and otherwise just having a good time. The Sana in question would be Sanna Marin, the 36-year-old Prime Minister of Finland, who's dancing and partying at a private event shown on a video that surfaced last week, has caused something of an uproar in Finland, including calls for her to take a drug test. She did. It was negative. Said the Prime Minister, "I have a family life, I have a work life, and I have free time to spend with my friends, pretty much the same as many people my age." I'm just going to say there is something else at play here, too, in this scrutiny of a highly accomplished woman. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino covers the workplace for us.
Sure, leading a country is a unique job, but people bring a lot of the same assumptions when judging women in any position of authority, says Allison Elias, a business professor at the University of Virginia.
You already are sort of fighting against a more traditional definition of what we think of. So you really don't have as much room or space to bring, you know, other differences to the workplace.
Take academia. Elias says women professors often feel they need to be more formal to be taken seriously in their interactions with students, with colleagues, how they talk and how they dress. But sometimes that's not enough, or it can be too much, says Joan C. Williams, director of the Center for Work-Life Law at UC Hastings. She calls it the tightrope effect.
Which is women who behave in authoritative ways risk seeming rigid and unlikable unless they do it just so.
Even Williams, a distinguished legal scholar in her own right, says she walks that tightrope every day.
You know, you perform authority like mad, but then you soften it by being emotionally attuned to those around you.
Social psychologist Adam Galinsky at Columbia Business School has studied this form of bias, which he says applies not only to women, but anyone considered to be different in status.
That we have this instinctive negative reaction when we think someone has stepped outside of this unknown implicit boundary.
For instance, research from the American Psychological Association has shown Black job applicants receive lower pay offers when they're perceived as negotiating too hard. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's always, you know, challenging, like working with family.
Yeah, it is. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 154 points today, 0.4%, 32,909. The NASDAQ down just a quarter point, basically flat, 12,381. The S&P 500 down 9 points, about 0.2%, 41.28. A Twitter whistleblower is alleging, quote, extreme egregious deficiencies in security. The Washington Post and CNN both report that Twitter's former head of security says the company withheld from the board and regulators the existence of out-of-date security software and failed to disclose problems related to had access to key systems and data and sat on knowledge of major security incidents that affected large numbers of users. The company, in a sense, almost verbatim, denies it. Twitter subtracted 7.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The start of a new school year also means, for those of you with middle and high schoolers, the start of middle and high school sports. But as a lot of parents will readily attest, kids' sports is so very much bigger than just school teams. It is, says Linda Flanagan in her new book, Take Back the Game. It's an ecosystem of business interests, up to and including the private travel sports leagues some might be familiar with, also the facilities that house those leagues, and then the college athletic system. So question number one for Linda Flanagan was, of course, how big the youth sports ecosystem might actually be.
Well, the estimate is that it's a $19 billion industry, and that's a 90% increase since 2010, I should add.
It's a lot of money.
It's more than the NFL, which is $15 billion.
Wow. Context is everything. That's a crazy comparison.
It really is.
And that money is coming from where? Parents, I guess, right? Who want their kids to play all these sports.
Yes. It goes into travel, to equipment, to team memberships. There's an entire world out there that is offering sports options to parents, and they're paying up. In fact, parents pay reportedly $30 billion a year for their kids' sports.
It seems to me... literally a recipe for haves and have-nots. Because if you're some upper-middle-income family who can afford, and look, my kids played baseball when I was a kid, and there were like $250 baseball bets, which, for the record, I did not buy for my kids because that's insane.
But they've gone up.
Yeah, and they've gone up, right? So not every parent can afford that. And so you have kids who simply can't participate in the bulk of sports today, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's one of the biggest social problems related to the commercialization of kids' sports, because it's now sports are basically class-based. The higher class you are, the more you participate. The lower income, the less likely you are to play.
So let's talk about the third leg of the ecosystem here, colleges.
Yes.
You point out in this book that the college admissions process incentivizes parents to get their kids playing whatever the sport is from an incredibly young age to boost their odds of getting into college 15 years later. And that seems to me just to be, well, the whole thing seems, frankly, out of whack. But how does that work?
Well, I don't think the colleges would put it that way, that they incentivize parents to do this, but that's kind of the result of
it.
Because there are notable admissions advantages in terms of having lower SAT scores being required. There's also a streamlined process to get in. Most athletes are recruited and admitted early, so they forego the drama of senior year in high school.
Yeah.
If you're anxious about your child's chances of getting into a good school, it may seem like a wise way to get them in.
So let's do a little bona fides here for you, right? Because you write this book as a mother of athletes, right? So that's one thing. But
yes.
more importantly, a just recently retired cross country coach for high school kids. Did you see this? What was your experience on the ground?
Well, this was what was so discouraging to me, is that I saw that the purpose of sports for many kids seemed to be not about what you can learn in my sport from running and training and being with young people your age, but it became about what can this do for my resume? What can this do for my college prospects? And also that just the great amount of pressure on young people. They feel such pressure to perform.
So the last thing I want to ask you, since you spend a lot of time on solutions in this book, I want to ask you what the answer is, because for all that kids do get out of sport, and let's be upfront about this, right? Because they can be really rewarding, they can be motivating, they can be they can teach discipline and camaraderie and all of those things.
Yes.
But it is systemically dysfunctional. So my question to you, and here comes the sort of pokey in the eye. Well, it's not really pokey in the eye, but you'll see what I mean, right? A number of days ago, the Big Ten Conference signed an $8 billion television deal.
Yes.
So how do we, in the face of that kind of unbelievable money, fix the feeder system?
Well, that's the question we'd all like the answer to, isn't it? And I think that it has to be incumbent on parents to realize that they have agency. And perhaps, in a perfect world, to organize and try to resist some of this together. Maybe, you know, as some of the young people who went through this process, they might start resisting this as well. And who knows what the tipping point is going to be, but I think it has to start in individual homes. And perhaps parents can organize and join leagues and teams and be on those boards to shape the conduct of those organizations.
Linda Flanagan has a new book out. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
If any of you out there work with or for, I guess, family, you know those ties run deep, as do, though, tradition and habit. And even though you do love your family, sometimes you want to change things up. Call it generational differences, I guess. Here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Amber Balakian, and I live in Fresno, California. And I am one of the owners of Balakian Farms. Our farm, like, officially was established in 1925. My great-grandfather immigrated during the Armenian Genocide, and he settled in the Central Valley, and they bought a ranch. The whole family was involved, and my grandfather, when he got older and married my grandmother, they bought a ranch that's actually about 5 minutes from the original ranch. My mother's the one that actually started growing the heirloom tomatoes in the early 90s, which is when we transitioned to organic. I, you know, was always involved in the farming. But I did go away to college and thinking, you know, I'm going to do something else, kind of get away from everything. I actually ended up coming back because I kind of like I didn't know what I had until I left it. And so when I came back, that's when I started producing consumer packaged products or CPG products, which are just processed products in a package. And I started making a blended heirloom tomato sauce using my grandma's recipe. So I continue to do that today, and I'm also pretty involved in the fresh produce sales for our farm. It's always, you know, challenging, like, working with family, especially a lot of our practices have been going on for, you know, decades. So it's like trying to change anything that's so ingrained like that is always a challenge. And so things that I've like looked into changing, I guess the biggest one is focusing on social media to kind of increase our brand awareness. And for us, like, Instagram is just where it's at. And they'll say, like, why are you taking so many photos? Or why are you always recording things? Or why do we have to have somebody come out and take video? It has resulted in new retailers that have reached out to us. It's not always easy to make those changes, and it takes time and you get frustrated, but I think it's worth it in the end.
Social media is everything, right? Fourth generation farmer Amber Balakey in there. She's up in Fresno. No matter where you are or what you do, we cannot do this series without you. So please let us know what is going on with you at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, Andy Euler, you might remember, was telling us the other day about how drought everywhere is affecting electricity and power supplies everywhere. And you might have heard the Rhine River in Germany is really low. Here's another one. Saw this in Bloomberg. The drought in China's Sichuan province has cut into hydroelectric power generation over there so badly that skyscrapers in Shanghai, which are huge and spectacular, have had to dim their lights for 2 days. All right, out of here we are, but here's your moment of economic context. It's actually sort of just random information, but anyway. My iPhone told me this afternoon that it had to restart to adjust for new time zone definitions. I'm sure everything's fine, but I figured you'd want to know. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.